For the week of October 4th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 23, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gilt.
Well, we have a ton of news to go over this week. We do not have a guest. So maybe instead of introducing our guest, I should say, please go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast and rate our podcast. You can rate it with 5 stars for it being, you know, the best podcast on the internet. Or you can rate it 1 or 0 stars because you'd be criminally insane.
No. You can only rate it 5 stars. Thanks for playing.
Right, four stars means you don't like it. You can do 5 or 4.
Well, Michael, I think every week we start off with box office. So why don't you review the box office for us?
I will, Sperling. Actually, we have two new movies and one old new movie are at the big box office news. The number one movie of the week, the biggest opening ever for Woody Harrelson, is Zombieland with a $25 million gross. And when you gross more than your budget for your film in the first weekend, you know you're doing all right.
That's number a fun two movie. Have you seen it?
I have. It was. I thought it was really fun. As you follow my Twitter, you'll know I gave it 3 stars out of 4.
If you followed Michael on Twitter, Michael Giltz is the name to look up. You would know all of the movies that Michael sees, exactly when he sees them, and what he thinks of them.
Yeah,
on Twitter, you would know that Industry Nexus was setting up free screenings.
That's right. How did they go? I bet they were really popular.
They were really popular.
And you can actually visit Industry Nexus at industrynexus.com, the home site of Karen Woodward.
Shameless plug!
Zombieland was really fun. It was a really good success story. It got good reviews. Everybody agrees that, you know, if you think you're going to like it, you're going to like it. It's just, you know if you're not really into a zombie comedy, you probably know already. If you're on the fence and you think you might be okay, well, go see it because it's a fun, smart movie. A lot of fun, very clever. Jesse Eisenberg, is that his name?
Yep.
Yeah, who was in The Squid and the Whale, terrific there. And earlier this year was in Adventureland, and now he's in Zombieland. He's cornering the land market of movies. But that's really a big win for Sony, which also had the number two movie of the week, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which was a very good animated film, and it held really well. It sold $16 million, even though it lost a lot of screens on 3D to Toy Story 2. Because, in fact, I was outside of New York City, and, in fact, the town I was in, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, wasn't even playing in 3D that week because Toy Story 2 double feature took it out and took control of all the 3D screens, and that grossed $12 million to be number three. That's probably one of the few times in Hollywood history in the last 20 years. You've got your Star Wars movies, maybe your Lord of the Rings. There aren't many times when a movie that's a few years or even months old can come back on and score that on at the box office. Number four was the new Ricky Gervais film, the creator of The Office. He was in The Invention of Lying, which made $7.3 million. Number
Have
five was
that?
The Bruce. No, I haven't. It seems like his last movie, Ghost of a Chance, or what was that called?
Ghost Town,
which got a little better reviews, did a little worse. And The Invention of Lying got a little worse reviews and is doing a little better. I love The Office. I like extras, and I should have seen The Invention of Lying, but I didn't get to see it.
Moral of the story, get bad reviews and big box office.
Exactly. And number five was Surrogates, the Bruce Willis film at $7.3 million. That's at $26 million total. Basically a flop. It's really disappearing quickly. Number six is Capitalism, a Love Story, the Michael Moore movie, which made $4.8 million. It bumped up a few screens. It's doing really well.
Well, there was a tie for sixth and seventh place, which was Whippet and Capitalism, a Love Story.
Whippet was the next. Oh, they've switched the order of the. Well, it's a tie at sixth place. You're right. Whippet was the Drew Barrymore movie. Now, that movie I did see. Did you see, Karen?
No, I haven't. How is it?
It's okay. I wish I could say nicer things. I don't wish it ill, but it's a very routine movie. Young high school. I thought it was a period piece, actually. I thought it was going to be set in the 50s or early 60s when roller derby first came to light. But in fact, it's contemporary. It's set outside Austin, Texas, where roller derby had a comeback. And our heroine, Ellen Page, is a cool high schooler who has no friends, whose mom forces her to go to beauty pageants. And she rebels by becoming a roller derby queen. And it's fine. It's just very, very, very familiar. There's nothing particularly special about it. So Whippet had a little weaker opening. Toy Story 2 probably did a little better than people expected. Whippet is, 4.8 million is, there's no way to dress that up as anything other than a pretty modest opening. And right behind that was Fame, which made 4.7 million, and it's now probably made back about the budget of the film. Behind that is The Informant, the Matt Damon film, which is really good, but it's disappearing fast. That made 3.8 million for a total of 26 million. And number 10 was Little Happens, the swiftly disappearing Jennifer Aniston film, which grossed 2.7 million. So the big success story was Zombieland and movies that are 10 or 15 years old, Toy Story and Toy Story 2.
Now, I said last week that that would actually be the case, that we would be reporting that a movie that's over 10 years old topped the box office. I was wrong about that, but I was at least right that it was in the top three.
Yeah, you were right that it opened, but it made half of what the number one movie of the week made. Oh, that brings me to one more point. If you guys have been going to the theaters, I have seen more trailers for movies coming out in January and February than I can ever recall. I mean, we haven't even hit the Thanksgiving or Christmas period, and I'm seeing a lot of ads for movies like When in Rome and other things that are coming out. It's really, Hollywood is really programming year-round now, and they're not throwing turkeys out in January. You know, even if they've got a turkey, they're going to try and sell it. You know, January, February is not a graveyard anymore. They realize they've got a program year-round. Can't waste 2 months of the year just sort of living off the Christmas movies.
Well, North American exhibitors, and I think, frankly, exhibitors around the world, have always asked for a year-round exhibition market. They have always cried at every cinema trade show that the year has 12 months, and they have begged the studios to please realize that. So they're getting their wish. But I think this year, the reality is that some of these films, the studios want to push the marketing budget off into the new year so that they don't have to count it on what they consider to be a very down year.
Well, fair enough, but I've never seen it before. You know, I've never seen this many ads for movies coming out in January and February back in September and October.
Well, yeah, that's true.
And it used to happen for like a summer. You'd see a movie for like coming out the following summer and think, oh my gosh, I have to wait 6 months. But these are romantic comedies and smaller films coming out in January and February, like When in Rome. And it's definitely a sort of a new thing. But I mean, we saw trailers for Toy Story 3, which comes out in June 2010. So it's not new, but it is new that way in advance teasing is happening earlier and earlier, even for smaller films, not just big event films. And it's new, I think, that they're really pushing and promoting movies that come out in January and February, because they realize no movie that costs $30, $40, $50 million can be a throwaway anymore. I don't think you should be cynical anymore, because they're not putting all the dogs in January, February. They're releasing movies that they actually believe in January, February, at least movies they think can be commercial, even if they're not Oscar nominees. So I don't think you should be cynical anymore about that. These aren't just dogs.
Well, speaking about dogs, my favorite story of the week has been David Letterman.
How did I know that's where you were going the second you said that?
I have not had a chance to watch this because CBS keeps making YouTube take it down. But, and for those of you who don't know, Letterman has been the victim of an extortion attempt by a man who works for, does anybody remember?
48 Hours, the CBS news show.
Who has proof that he has over the years been having flings with young staff members. And
this is surprising how?
Well, I find this whole thing, especially when combined with Roman Polanski, I find it very upsetting. You know, he first of all, he's been with Regina, whatever her, his wife, Regina Lansky or something, since 86. So surely he's been cheating on her this entire time. Supposedly he had this like bedroom off of his dressing room, which was like reserved for like hotties only. Like, okay, weird.
Wait a second. I did not read that anymore.
I've not heard this at all. What are you reading?
Yeah.
Apparently Karen used to be an intern on The Late Show with David Letterman.
No, this I got from a friend of mine who is really good at kind of like delving into the weird details of stories like this.
Has this been reported anywhere? Is this just your friend's fervid imagination?
It could just be her imagination. It was the first I'd heard of it too, but that's why I thought I'd bring it up, because I thought maybe you guys had heard about it.
No, I mean,
this is just fantasy.
Wouldn't be my fantasy, and me and an old man, but okay.
Well, and you should point out that his wife, the one that, you know, he's been married to since I think March, and who he has a 5-year-old son with, was his former assistant. That's where they met.
And
I think she wasn't an assistant. I think she was a writer on the show.
Well, his relationship before that was Meryl Marco. She was a writer. She was one of the head writers on the show, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, apparently that's how he meets his women. But I find the whole thing extremely upsetting because I don't see him. He's taking the role of the victim here. And, I mean, granted, it probably
is a victim. The guy tried to extort him $2 million. No. A guy tried to extort him.
That probably sucks. But you know what? Nobody is taking into account that what he essentially did was sexually harass women the whole time he's been in his show.
No. Nobody suggested that he sexually harassed anyone. If two adults decide to have sex, no one said, if you want to be on my show, you have to have sex with me. I don't believe anyone suggested that. This is just that he cheated on his girlfriend / wife. You know, there's a big difference between Roman Melanson.
He had a series of relationships with young women who worked on his show. How is that not inappropriate? How is that not at least borderline sexual harassment?
Well, because if it was mutual, it wasn't sexual harassment. And
He is the boss.
Well, look, the guy works something like 12 hours a day. So where else is he going to meet a woman?
This is what I find upsetting, is that Letterman is getting away with what to me is predatory behavior because of a boys will be boys mentality. Well, he works so long. Where else is he going to get it?
Where else are they going to meet men? That's what you're wondering, why they're dating anybody. Where else are you going to meet a guy?
You live there 24/7.
Have you ever worked on one of those shows? You do work quite hard. You're there 12 to 16 hours a day.
It's not appropriate. When you are the boss or when you are the star of a show, you don't go around having sex with young interns or employees or writers or whatever. You don't. You're opening yourself up to a lawsuit. You're opening yourself up for blackmail.
Well,
for him. And also what I find really alarming is that he went out in front of the audience and he joked about it.
Well, he didn't joke about it. If you watch it, he was sincere and he was he made fun of himself. He said that they'd be embarrassed about having had sex with him. I mean, he wasn't like yada, yada, yucky, yuck, yuck, yuck. And then he made another apology again to his wife on the air, of course. But I wouldn't, if it comes out that David Letterman pressured young interns to have sex with him, then I would say that was wrong. That was inappropriate and perhaps broke some company policy. Not even remotely comparable to Roman Polanski drugging and raping a 13-year-old minor. But I haven't heard anything other than the fact that he dated people that worked on his show. If you think that's impossible to date someone who worked on his show.
Then riddle me this. What are they blackmailing him for?
Because it's embarrassing that he cheated on his girlfriend or had relationships with other people while she thought they were dating in a monogamous relationship. There's nothing illegal or unethical about cheating on your spouse. It's not nice. It doesn't make him a nice person, but it's different than saying they sexually harass someone. And if he cheated on his spouse, that also makes him look poor, certainly. But I don't care about people's private lives. But if he sexually harassed someone, forced them to have sex with him as opposed to dating someone, they felt pressured to have sex with him in order to keep their job on the show, fine. I would say any of that, if it comes out, is inappropriate and wrong and makes him look bad. Cheating on your spouse makes you look bad. But, you know, the top line producer on the show is a lesbian. She certainly is not feeling pressured, you know. So, I mean, I know other people who work on the show, you know, if he's a jerk on the show, that would be sad to hear. It doesn't even remotely compare to Roman Polanski, though.
Well, and actually, we should say that what wound up happening was this producer gave him some evidence that he knew about his philandering and tried to blackmail him for $2 million. And after meeting with his attorney and meeting with the extortionist, got the police involved, and he had to go testify to a grand jury. Now, here's what I find interesting. He didn't have to say a word. He could have just let it slowly leak out. He did not have to say a word.
It would have
come out.
Of course
he
had to say a word.
That's what's so kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but that is what is sad, is that grand jury testimony, which is supposed to be sealed and not available to the public, is actually completely available to the public, and he knows that eventually it's going to come out. So he may as well stand up and talk about it and control the spin himself by being the person to talk about it. And Mary McNamara from the Los Angeles Times, I thought, wrote about it quite effectively. She said that the first 10 minutes of Thursday's show was one of the most masterfully produced bits of television theater we'll see in a long time. Rarely has a public figure controlled the revelation of possibly illegal and at the very least surprising sexual escapades with such a velvet glove and iron hand. She goes on to say it certainly was effective TV. His ratings went up 22% on Thursday. Some were put off by what they saw as Letterman making light of a serious situation, but that's not exactly what happened. He certainly did not make light of the blackmail, and as far
yeah, I bet he didn't.
And as far as his sex life, he simply seemed to think, shockingly enough, that it was his own business. If you're David Letterman, what are you going to do if a TV producer of a true crime show tried to blackmail you with the threat of a screenplay? You nail the sucker for blackmail, you admit the information is true, and you play it for laughs, and hope that Steve Martin is interested in the project. Steve Martin, by the way, is his guest tonight, so he can ask him.
Well, I don't think it was somehow sad that he felt the need to step forward. It was just smart and savvy. Grand jury testimony could remain sealed and may never be revealed, but the guy's eventually going to come up for trial. And at that point, it will become public knowledge, regardless of how sealed the grand jury testimony is.
That is
so
true.
Letterman just said, get ahead of the news curve and put it out yourself and spin it the way you want. And I'm with you totally, Karen. If it turns out that he's got a string of young women who come forward and say, yeah, this lecherous old jerk made me feel like I had to sleep with him in order to keep my job. Absolutely, that's totally wrong. He doesn't deserve a pass for that.
My personal belief is that the story will end here. But if it does come up that, you know, if it does go on, I think it's going to bring up the definition of what sexual harassment is. And, you know, a lot of people, and I think especially men, think that sexual harassment is, I will fire you unless you sleep with me. But it's so much more complicated than that. And I think that's probably, to me, the more interesting aspect of this is, what is sexual harassment? Of course, we're not going to answer that here.
Well, while we're on the subject of sex and dogs, I guess we should...
Oh, gross. Where are you Hello. Going with that?
I knew that would get your attention.
It sounds like a local news segment.
Sex and dogs, news at 11. Well, if it was a local news segment, of course, you do realize that nobody would see it if they were on NBC. Because
Ouch.
The local news, and this is a complete aside from the segue I was trying to make, but you were right, Michael, that the local news affiliates on NBC owned and operated networks, their local news hour, the late news, has plummeted after the primetime Jay Leno show. In New York, for example, it looks like WNBC was down 65%, the 11 o'clock news. The story was the same at LA's KNBC, where the Jay Leno show airs at 10 p.m., and the evening news fell 37%. In Chicago, it fell just 14%. ABC was down 11%, and CBS was up 27%. So you're right that all of these, you know, only pulling in 5 million viewers at the 10 o'clock hour, it's killing these local news shows.
Jay Leno is drawing the same size audience he drew in late night, and that's just not remotely big enough. And they're probably older and more tired. It's just not a big enough audience for a 10 p.m. show.
Yeah, but it's what the network promised advertisers.
Well, I don't know if they need to make goods or anything like that. I'm not saying that about that. But, you know, if other 10 p.m. shows are drawing 13, 14, 15 million people, you can't get by with 5.6. I don't know what they guaranteed to advertisers, but that's just not good enough for their – all their affiliates are going to be angry and say the ratings are too low, our local news are getting killed, and a lot of those stations are owned by the major networks, so they're going to find their profits taking a hit. If the local news ratings drop 30%, that's where they make a lot of their money.
Yeah. Well, how much really do they care about affiliates these days? Because, I mean, if they truly cared about their affiliates, would they be putting all their shows online?
Ooh, we'll talk about that later.
Goody.
don't jump ahead.
Okay, sorry, I didn't know we were talking about it.
Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Now, back to sex and dogs.
Back to sex and dogs. Does this mean we're talking about Polanski?
Well, what would ever give you that idea?
What is the latest news in the Polanski case?
Well, I don't know that there's any latest news. I mean, certainly...
Yes, there is. Did you hear about the lawyer?
What lawyer?
Okay.
There's so many lawyers involved in this case, you're going to have
supposedly, okay, and I'm not 150% certain about my facts, but this is basically what it is. In the documentary that we were talking about last week, there was a prosecutor who was interviewed, and he said that he had spoken with the judge in the case, and that they conferred, and that he had said to the judge, he advised him that he kind of throw the book at Polanski, and that he go around what the original agreement was with Polanski, and why Polanski pled out, because he was told that he was not going to get any more jail time.
Okay, so you're talking about the prosecutor David F. Wells, who in Marina Zenovich's film, a documentary which was released last year on HBO and then on video, Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired is the name of the film. He is depicted as conferring with the trial judge more than 30 years ago about Polanski's case. Wells said in the documentary that the judge took his advice in deciding to renege on a plea bargain and give Polanski additional prison time.
Right. And now he is admitting or saying that,
Claiming.
claiming that he actually never said any such thing.
He said, oh, I made that stuff up to look better, and I was trying to liven up the documentary because, of course, I knew exactly what the final cut looked like while I was being interviewed. And
okay, but can I say that I really believe that he made it up?
No, but he said it at the time. It's not that he's claiming he never said it. He said it on camera, and now
right.
he realizes that he's admitting he broke the law, and he's suddenly saying, whoops. He's trying to he didn't make it up then. He's lying now because he could go to jail for what he did, for what he did was illegal.
And
he's also kind of going back on it because he's looking at all of his fellow prosecutors and people across the DA's office and going, so how much work did I cause for you? How much money is this costing you?
Okay, but I'm going to come across, clearly this is a Karen anti-male episode, because I'm going to come across and say, never underestimate a man's ego. And I would not be surprised if he got in front of a camera and was just like, this is how cool I am. I said this and the judge listened to me.
Well, Marina Zenovich, who I tried to get on this show because, as you know, Michael and I know her, and Stephen Garrett, of course, is a good friend of hers, and I was trying to reach out to her, never got a response from her, and I thought, gee, maybe she's a little busy these days. And
I think she's overseas, or she's been overseas.
Well, actually, it turns out, you remember Lila Yacoub, right? The producer of the Polanski documentary?
Yes.
I thought, well, okay, I can't get Marina. I'll reach out to Lila and see if, I can reach Marina through Lila. And on her Facebook, it said, I'm not going to be on my U.S. cell for a while. I'm going to be on my Swiss cell. Here's the number. And I thought, very interesting. I wonder why she's in Switzerland this time of year. Could it be that Roman Polanski was just arrested there? Are they working on a sequel, which has been rumored for some time? Indeed, they are working on a sequel. And while Steven Soderbergh executive produced the first film on Polanski, it turns out Brett Ratner, the director, is actually financing the second film to be, or the continuation of the story, the sequel, if you will. And so he's going to be producing that. Now, Brett Ratner is
There's a step down.
Oh, ouch.
Well, Brett Ratner is actually a friend of Polanski. They visited Auschwitz together.
Two dogs.
Is this meant to be like a DVD add-on, or is it meant to be an entirely separate standing feature film?
An entirely separate documentary.
Huh.
While I couldn't get Marina on the phone, in fact, Chris Libby, who is her publicist, I spoke with him late Friday, and he said, look, I can't get her. She's working, and she's 9 hours ahead of us. She did actually release a statement about David F. Wells. She says, and this is thanks to Ann Thompson on Thompson on Hollywood, she has a statement posted on her blog from Marina, which reads, for the record, on the day I filmed Mr. Wells at the Malibu Courthouse, February 11th, 2005, he gave me a one-hour interview. He signed a release, like all my other interviewees, giving me permission to use his interview in the documentary worldwide. At no time did I tell him that the film would not air in the United States. Mr. Wells was always friendly and open with me. At no point in the 4 years since our interview has he ever raised any issues about its content. In fact, in a July 2008 story in the New York Times, Mr. Wells corroborated the account of events that he gave in my film. I am astonished that he has now changed his story. It is a sad day for documentary filmmakers when something like this happens. So that's Zenovich's statement.
Well, I'm going to go with Karen, perhaps, on this one. I have found some of the aghast comments from Hollywood and the international film community as a bit ridiculous. So, like, the man is a fugitive from justice. However much we think there was a mess up in the final sentencing or the potential final sentencing that forced Polanski to flee the country, he's a fugitive from justice. There's legal matters that need resolving. He was almost able to work out a deal and come back and get it dealt with, but he hasn't done that yet. So there's a warrant out for his arrest, and he's going to a country, and they know, and they arrest him. They act like it's this horrific tragedy and travesty that he should be arrested when there's been a warrant out on him for 30 years. And it's a little silly. France had a great piece. There was a French television piece making fun of a politician or a government official who said that, this was so terrible. Polanski's made so many great films, they shouldn't do this. And they had a puppet on a show talking about some mass murder. And he said, he deserved to be in jail. But if he had made Citizen Kane, I would let him go. it's just like.
But that's what, people like Harvey Weinstein, that's what they're saying.
Exactly. It's ridiculous.
Such a talented artist. This is a travesty of justice. What? They have nothing to do with one another. What are you talking
right.
about?
Harvey Weinstein said, whatever you think of his so-called crime.
So-called crime? He was convicted of it. What are you talking
right.
about?
Exactly. It was not a so-called crime. He admitted to it. And the only person I'll defend is Whoopi Goldberg, who was not trying to minimize what Polanski did, but to make the distinction between rape, statutory rape, what the gradations of what he was found guilty of or what he pled guilty to. So she wasn't exactly saying, oh, it was no big deal. She doesn't fall into the Harvey Weinstein category.
No, but she spoke like a stupid person. If you have not read the transcript of that woman's, the girl's
testimony.
Originally when she was, testimony, it's so upsetting to read it.
Wait a second. You know, it is upsetting to read it. I agree with you. It's grand jury testimony that we were never meant to read. Okay, A.
Who cares?
And I'm not defending Polanski.
She's spoken in public. She can go forward and say whatever she wants.
That's
now.
Right.
Now, grand jury testimony is not never meant to be seen, ever heard from. It can be released. It can be put in the public record. And she has come forward and confirmed
it. Anybody a free pass?
Yeah, she come forward. I don't know what your thing is about grand jury testimony, but she's come forward and confirmed all the details. Polanski hasn't denied any of the details that she's ever offered forward. What he did, he did, and he's admitted to that, and he's served some time and deserved to be on probation and have whatever penalties were appropriate.
Right. Well, and now, of course, he should be arrested just for. Actually, it is supposed to be kept sealed.
No, grand jury testimony can in fact be unsealed. It's not. It doesn't mean it disappears forever and should never, ever, ever be heard from.
But what I'm trying to warn people of is you're reading one side of a story. That, and I'm not saying that Polanski is right or he didn't do what he did.
He pled guilty.
He pled guilty.
What I'm saying is,
whenever you read grand jury testimony like that, you are reading one person's testimony. You're not reading the other person's testimony. So it doesn't matter.
The same is true of trial testimony. Every bit of testimony is one person's account. It doesn't matter whether it's in the grand jury or on a stand or in a newspaper quoted by a reporter. Or on Barbara Walters, it's always one person's point of view.
Well, which is precisely why people go to trial so that they get a chance to defend themselves. In this case, he never testified, and so there is no testimony.
He pled guilty.
That's right.
He made an arraignment.
He didn't have to testify
and
admit right. From his point of view exactly what happened.
Yeah, no, he had made an agreement. He agreed. He made a plea agreement that he had committed statutory rape and went to jail, served a certain amount of time, and should have been able to be out on probation and have this all put behind him 30 years ago, except for the apparent misbehavior of the judge that Marina Zenovich made so clear. It's a very good documentary, Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. If you watch it, it makes you think much less of Roman Polanski. You know, if you just sort of vaguely know the details, watching that movie makes you go, wow, what a sleazeball.
That is very true.
No. Scary sleazeball.
I mean, at the very least, you should be arrested for basically fleeing. That was against the law. That alone was against the law. So, you know, if they said, look, we're going to drop this whole rape case, you're being...
Yeah, but we're sending you to jail because you're a fugitive from justice.
Right, exactly.
But he hasn't had a repeat offense. He had an agreement in place that the prosecution and the defense agreed upon. The judge should have stuck to that agreement, and there's no reason why he should have to go back to jail now for the fleeing of the country. They should be able to come to an agreement that would keep him out of jail today. There's no reason to see him as a threat anymore. He did his time. He served his probationary period. If perhaps he needs to be on probation for a little while longer, but this should be resolved legally. There's nothing more for him to be thrown into jail for. He spent 30 years on the lam and unable to come into this country and numerous other countries. I think he's paid his price, and he did fulfill the agreement that was in place at the time between him and the prosecution. So I don't think there's any outstanding jail time that he needs to face just because he's a jerk.
First off, the LA Times has done a really good job of covering this particular case. Of course, it's in their backyard, so they darn well better do a good job.
Better.
Yeah, John Horn had a piece called In Roman Polanski Case, Is It Hollywood Versus Middle America? And you'll have to forgive me, he had a co-writer on that, and I did not write it down. But he says, the rest of the nation seems to hold a dramatically different perspective on Polanski's weekend capture than Hollywood does. And he quotes Bozenga, and Bozenga is a producer here in Hollywood. He says, I think these people have honestly forgotten what this is really about. Everyone needs to go back and read the grand jury testimony to remember how vicious this rape was, because right now everyone thinks we're debating whether or not Polanski got a raw deal. It irritates me that people around the world think that all of Hollywood is saying that the rapist is the victim, because I don't feel that way, and neither do most of the people I talk with.
Oh.
Well, I guess, you know, time will see how this plays out. And hopefully we can get Marina on and she can speak for herself and say what she has to say about the whole thing. Steve Lopez from the LA Times. Steve Lopez is a columnist there, and he is also the columnist that wrote the story that was turned into a movie called The Soloist, and he is the character, Robert Downey Jr. plays his character in the film. He wrote a scathing piece called Polanski's Defenders Lose Sight of the Real Victim. And he, of course, talks about the grand jury transcripts, and he says his victim, who settled a civil case against Polanski for an unspecified amount, said she does not want the man who forced himself on her to serve additional time. That's big-hearted of her, but also irrelevant. And so is the fact that the victim had admitted to having sex with a boyfriend before meeting Polanski. There may well have been judicial misconduct, but no misconduct was greater than allowing Polanski to cop to a plea to the least of his charges. His crime was graphic, manipulative, and heinous, and he got a pass. It's unbelievable, really, that his soft-handed apologists are rooting for him to get another one.
I disagree with him. The sentencing was not out of place for what would happen at the time. The girl didn't want to go to trial. It's very difficult to prosecute these cases. They made agreement. He went to jail. You know, this is a world famous director who was going to jail. You know, it's not exactly like he got a free pass. It was, you know, it was a very much in line with sentencing for that charge at that time. It was not
that's true?
Yeah, that's in the film. Yeah, absolutely.
What they're saying now is that it very well may come down to him saying, you know what, I void the plea. I'm not going to plea. And the DA will have to start the case all over again without the main testimony,
witness.
The main witness, yeah, i.e. the victim.
Right. She has sued him in civil court. He's paid her money. He went to jail. He served time. He should have been on probation for years. Happily, as far as we know, he hasn't repeated this offense again. So, you know, the idea that he got off light is, I don't think, accurate.
Can I just ask, none of us here are actually condoning what Roman Polanski did or think that he's a good guy or think that he should get off.
I think hopefully we've made that clear.
Well, yeah, but I'm going to disagree with you, Michael, and think that he absolutely got a free pass by only going to jail for however long he was there. That, to me, was a free pass all the way.
But, you know, it's when you're trying to make a deal agreement and trying to avoid going to trial with a witness who doesn't want to go on the trial, doesn't want to go to the face the circus of what that would have meant. You know, that's not a bad deal. And
to me, the victim also loses, because think about why she didn't want to go to trial. The victim in these scenarios is always ultimately the loser.
Well, there's no way to be a winner when you've been raped, obviously, but she made him admit his guilt. He went to jail. He paid her a lot of money in a settlement we don't know the details of, but she sued him in civil court successfully. He agreed to pay her presumably a significant sum and all her lawyer fees.
Well, there's no good segue.
Yeah, but
yes, there is. There's a great segue, which is that we've dealt with Letterman, we've dealt with Polanski. Let's move on to John and Kate Plus Eight. John cheating on his wife. We learned that TLC said that the TV show formerly known as John and Kate Plus Eight will now be known as Kate Plus Eight. Dropping the John and.
I saw her on the Today Show this morning, and she was like crying about how now she can't pay her bills because now that he's shut down production, that she can't make any money, and he's gone into their bank accounts and he's taken out $230,000, and she was just weeping. I can't feed my kids. I can't put a roof over my head.
Oh my gosh.
But that Karen finds funny.
Because nobody should be depending on a reality show every week to keep a roof over their head.
Here's what I find so fascinating about this story. And ordinarily, I wouldn't care about it. But what I think is so interesting is that all of America goes back and forth between who is the devil in this case. Because at first, she was the bad guy. She was like, you know, she was a ball buster and he was just this poor guy who was just trying to be a dad. And she was just, you know, such a witch. And, you know, isn't life terrible for John? Then they get divorced and John goes out and just does everything that, like, you should not do. You know, he's doing drugs, he's drinking, he's womanizing, he's getting fancy bachelor pads. And she's
so
like,
you're saying he's basically like he's being a cross between Roman Polanski and David Letterman.
Yeah, he's going out being a scumbag. By the way, we should call this show the Scumbag Edition. So he's going out being a scumbag. And she's photographed with, like, taking her kids to the beach and taking her kids to get ice cream. And now all of a sudden we feel sorry for her. Now all of a sudden her haircut's not quite so bad. This is awesome. Kate, get a job. I don't know what to tell you. All the rest of us have to.
Well, speaking of television, have really bad segue here of something that I don't even have on the show notes, but I just want to know if either of you have noticed that on ABC, they are really plugging Disneyland in just about every show. I watched Modern Family, and they mentioned Disneyland. And then I watched Flash Forward, and they also mentioned Disneyland. And I was wondering, I thought,
pick up on that.
How ironic. I just happened to TiVo both of them and watch them back to back. And so that's kind of why I noticed it. It dawned on me after the second or third time I heard it on an ABC show that ABC is owned by Disney. Very surreptitious.
Wow, that's synergy for you.
Speaking of synergy, I have a segue.
Ooh.
Speaking of synergy, how about that book? It's both a book, a computer, and video. I have no idea what it is, but I just thought it was like...
It's a video and a book.
It's video and a book.
It's book.
It's an irresistible new combination of a video and text that offers unrivaled storytelling experience.
It's what Russian people read, a vuk.
Oh my God.
That was perfect. This is actually something created by Simon and Schuster, and it's a new format, and they think they're just going to, they put it out with big fanfare. It's a book, not a video, not a book, but a combination. And the idea is that you'll buy a short story for like $7, and maybe it's a short story set during, a spy during World War II, and you'll be reading the book, and suddenly there'll be video to watch, and you'll click on the video and watch a dramatization of a scene or some information that's not in the actual text, but some new storyline, and you'll watch that scene, and then go back to reading the text, and then you'll watch another scene, and then you'll read the text, and it's just going to blow your mind and be so wonderful and exciting. So they're releasing a couple of things. They're releasing an exercise thing, which has some video, which of course, there's a million exercise videos. They have a short story, an original short story by Richard Deutsch, which includes video, and they have a nonfiction something or other, which includes video. It's literally the stupidest thing about it. They're just paranoid and pathetic. They're scared out of their minds by the book industry collapsing. They don't know what to do, and they come up with this ridiculous idea of a book. And I mean, I'd been in a meeting, I would have said, Avuk, the great Tolstoy. It's like reading War and Peace, and then you click on a battle scene, and instead of reading about the battle scene, they dramatize it for you, and then you go back to reading the short story. It's just
okay, but
dumb beyond
doesn't
belief.
It sound like something kids might like?
No, it sounds ridiculous. There are actually young adult novels and things that have come with online content or video content that adds to the excitement. You'll read a book in a series, and they'll send you online to watch some extra stuff with extra clues. So they've been doing a little bit of that, trying to get kids excited. But to me, it's you're going to pay $7 for a short story that's going to have some video in it. It's ridiculous.
Well, and then there's the whole concept of paying $9.99 for a book, which is what the Kindle charges. In fact, Michelle Phillips who was on
Everything.
She was on Everything. Hey, very good. This is like sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. She is an actress. She was on the sitcom One Day at a Time with
Valerie
Bertinelli.
Talking about Mackenzie Phillips, not Michelle.
Michelle Phillips.
Michelle Phillips is her stepmother. The mamas and the papas.
Okay, whatever.
Who was probably also on Everything, but she wasn't on TV.
Well, apparently the reason she was on Everything is because her father was shooting her up with heroin at the age of like 14 or 18. I don't know.
I'm not sure that's entirely true. I mean, I think she was doing heroin with him, and he might have been shooting her up, but that was only his favor. Like, she was like forced to do drugs.
Yeah, I can't believe we skipped over this, but
she's a minor.
The reason I'm bringing this up now is because her book went on sale last week. It's $15 if you buy the hardcover, and it's $15 if you buy the electronic edition. But the big news coming out of the book is that she basically had some like 10-year-long incestuous affair with her father.
Okay, this is another one of those stories that I just find just wonderfully fascinating. Like, disgusting. Oh my God, I want to read more. I believe her. Do you guys believe her?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, back to books. Michael, okay, do you think books will be Napsterized?
I'm not sure how you segued into that. So I got completely I thought you were going to tell us how much it cost on ebook. If it's $15.99, it's unusual. Most of them are $9.99.
Oh, okay. So getting back to that for just a split second, I guess Amazon thought that they could charge $15.99 for it, or somebody in that chain, whether it's the publisher or the writer, somebody thought they could charge the same amount for the hardback book as for the electronic book. That lasted only like 2 days before all of a sudden the ebook version was $9.99.
Well, exactly. Well, this is just the panic in the book industry. You know, they saw what happened in the music industry when iPods came along, and they're worried that now the Sony Reader, the Kindle, with the iPod Touch coming out in tablet form, that maybe they're going to reach a tipping point and have people start reading ebooks, and people are going to start downloading books for free and just reading them on ebooks, and that they'll lose their entire industry. So they're doing vooks, and they're just panicking out of their mind. And it's ridiculous because they've got these things. If you go online and you buy like the Mackenzie Phillips book, it probably costs about $30 to buy it on audiobook form. It costs $10 to buy it on digital form as an ebook, or it costs $15 to $20 to buy a hardcover book version of it. And they want people, you know, to have to pick and choose which way they want to read the book, have to decide, do I want to listen to it in the car going to work, or do I want to read it on my laptop, or do I want to have a hardcover copy I can put on my shelf? They're forcing people to jump through hoops and spend, you know, $20, $60, $80 just to consume one book in three different formats. What they should do is what the video industry did, which is what they came out with DVDs, which were much better than VHS tape. They were cheaper, and they had better picture, better sound, and they included lots of bonus features like audio commentary, you know, extra scenes that didn't make the final cut, documentaries about the making of the film, and those were all free. And in fact, the DVD costs less than VHS tape. And what they should do with books, if you want to include a book, if you want to include some video, whatever, fine. Sell them a copy of the book in hard copy form, and then give them a free audiobook, give them a free ebook, and give them any free bonus extra features that they want to make it more appealing. And maybe they'll hold on to their audience. But if they make people choose and spend more money just to get it in audiobook or ebook version and have to not even have a hard copy, they're going to lose all these readers who are going to just say, heck, why am I going to pay $50 for an audiobook version when I can get it for free at the library or steal it online? It's like if they sold you a CD and said you got to pay extra if you want to play it in your car. You got to pay extra if you want to hear it on your iPod. You got to pay extra if you want to listen to your stereo at home. You have to tell us which way you want to buy it and buy it three different times, or just buy the darn CD and play it any which way you want.
Dogs. The publishers are dogs, I tell you.
Publishers are total dogs.
The truth of the matter is that with the Amazon Kindle being a success for the most part, and the
modest, very modest success.
But it wasn't a flop, yeah, like, say, the Apple Newton back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And the Sony e-reader, also a modest success, that everybody's looking at the early 2000s and saying, wow, remember when the iPod came out and nobody thought it would really take off? Well, we don't want to miss the boat on this ebook craze, so we're all going to come out with our own books, our own electronic books. The problem is, of course, that there's a number of varying ebook formats, and there are some that are open standards and some that are not and have digital rights management surrounding them. So nobody knows where this is going to go, but nobody wants to miss the boat either.
No, you're right. Everybody should have an open format. Whether you buy your book from Sony or Simon & Schuster, shouldn't matter. If you buy it, you should download it and be able to play it on any reader that you have. You know, these digital rights management stuff, they should skip it for the books. It doesn't work. If people want to steal it, they will. The easier you make it for people to do, the more likely they are to go to a legitimate source and buy it. People are happy to buy stuff legally, safely, and cheaply. You just can't make it a pain in the neck for them. I don't want to buy it. I'm never buying a Kindle until they convince me that it's an open format and that they're not going to take the book back when they decide a license is over. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, did you hear about this kid who successfully sued Amazon because they took down 1984 and he had all of his notes on it?
Yes, that's old news.
Oh, well, I just read about it this week, so I'm a little bit behind in my Amazon news.
Speaking of being behind the times, during prep, we discussed a story about Lady Gaga, and apparently I'm just totally unhip and have no clue who she really is, but or didn't until recently. But we have a new segment that we're going to try out after Hiatus or Back Nine proved so successful last week. We have a new segment called Big Deal or Big Whoop. We are going to run through some of these headlines that occurred over the last week and decide whether the stories are a big deal and we should worry about, or whether it's something we shouldn't care about, in which case it's big whoop. So the first one, since I already mentioned Lady Gaga, is the fact that she's going back out on tour. She was meant to go on tour with Kanye West, but he's taking some time off, and the fame kills.
I love that. Yeah. I haven't taken some time for myself in so long. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Well, he's got some time to himself because apparently the Fame Kills tour did not have very good ticket sales when it went on sale, so the tour was effectively canceled. Lady Gaga said, yeah, who cares? I'm going out anyway. The tour will start 1 week after the original tour was supposed to start. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop.
Big whoop.
See, for me,
artist goes on tour.
I had no idea really who she was. I mean, I knew that she was a pop artist, but I saw her on Saturday Night Live, where she also had a little skit with Madonna, which did not look like Madonna at all, but whatever.
She looks good.
Madonna looks like she had face work done.
Oh, you think? Did you see her on David Letterman?
Letterman, yeah. I was very sad to see that. Yeah, she was on Letterman and had a slice of New York pizza, which she claims she never had, even though she grew up in the New York area. It seems beyond possibility to me that she never
bizarre.
Had a slice of pizza. I'm very sad when I see, you know, strong women who I like who look like they've had work done, because it just depresses the heck out of me.
Well, if you get a chance, definitely take a look at Lady Gaga's performance on Saturday Night Live. As apparently everybody but me knows, as Karen and Michael told me during prep,
it's so cute and it's interesting.
Well, she wears these like outlandish outfits, these like space-aged kind of freakish
right,
outfits.
I love that this is like news to you.
Well, she was performing on Saturday Night Live, and she had these like weird ring, Saturn ring, like atomic circles around her, and she could barely get them to move while she was standing at the microphone. And then she decided, I'm going to go sit down at the piano, which was a really not so bright move because she couldn't sit down because the rings were in the way. So she kind of had to stop everything, and she like waved to the audience just to kind of like break the tension, because everybody didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I don't know. It was a great moment.
Do you want to explain to people what Saturday Night Live is?
Yeah. Did you know that there's a show that's on Saturday nights, and it's like funny?
Okay, for the last 35 years, on
if it was
NBC,
funny, that would be news.
On Saturday evenings at around 11:30 after the late night news, there's been a show taped live from New York. Okay, moving on. MTV to air DJ AM reality series. Of course, DJ AM, we mentioned earlier on this show, on episode, who knows, I don't know. Which
was news to you at the time, too.
Yeah, who the heck was DJ AM?
I never heard of him either.
His show Gone Too Far, they had 8 episodes filmed, taped, produced, whatever you want to call it. When he died, apparently this week they released the autopsy results of an accidental overdose. His show Gone Too Far was about him talking to teenagers about the threat or the seriousness or the reality of being addicted to drugs, something he apparently knew a lot about.
I'm not sure it was actually his show per se. It was a show that he was on.
Okay, it was a show he was on. MTV has decided they're going to air it even though he has died of a drug overdose. Big deal.
I think they should.
So big deal or big whoop?
I don't particularly care about it, but I think that it's a big deal that MTV is doing this.
Michael?
Well, he hosted the series, so I think it's, I don't want to say big whoop, but I have no comment.
Moving on, Sony and Mark Burnett, the reality TV show producer, are going to visit Fantasy Island. They are going to turn Fantasy Island, the 1970s and 80s series, which starred Ricardo Montalban as the mystical Mr. Rourke, who made island visitors' dreams come true. They're going to turn it into a reality show. And the producers are in talks now with several different resorts in locales across the globe in order to find a setting for the show that's appropriate, or a setting for the show that will pay to be the setting for the show. And it turns out that the reality version will follow 12 contestants as they compete to become the real-life Mr. or Mrs. Rourke.
I think that's a great idea.
I will say big deal, even though the list of bad shows that Mark Burnett has done certainly outnumbers the good shows. But he's had his hits, The Apprentice, you know, Survivor, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? It's not a bad run, but he's had a lot of shows that haven't worked, like Shark Tank and The Contender and Toughest Cowboy. And
but God bless him for trying.
On
right?
The Lot.
Toughest
and
Cowboy?
Remember that? That was one about Rodeo Cowboy, so I was really into that because I follow the rodeo. I follow the bull riding. And he also
you
had a show...
Do?
Oh, big time. I've interviewed cowboys. I love bull riding.
Oh.
We'll talk about bull riding when we hit Vegas in October. It's in the end of October. So it's easy to forget that, you know, you have more misses than hits, but Fantasy Island is certainly a smart idea to turn into a reality show.
Moving on, Arrested Development script is in the works. Of course, Arrested Development was the I guess not so hit television show since it was canceled, but it was
the cult classic
television show. Apparently a script is in the works. This has long been rumored and much talked about on the internet. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
Big whoop. They don't have everybody
signed. Oh, sorry. That's what I meant. Big whoop, because I don't.
Yeah, big whoop. They don't have the people signed yet. They're working on a script. You know, who cares?
Yeah,
they haven't settled it yet. Unless everybody signed the dotted line and it's a green light and they're filming, it's a big whoop.
It's a big whoop until they're in production, in which case it will be a big deal. Okay, Showtime renews Californication for another year. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Big whoop. I like David Duchovny a lot, but it's just a modestly scoring show. It's just a good show for Showtime standards. Anybody else would have canceled it long ago.
All right. Finally, Warner Brothers announces a Friday the 13th Part 2 movie. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Don't you mean Friday the 13th Part 22?
Well, big I whoop. Don't know. Whatever they... Yeah, big whoop. Okay. Moving on to Inside Baseball. This week, obviously... Wow, we have a bunch of stuff to talk about Inside Baseball. We should, I guess, quickly mention the fact... I say quickly because it's actually huge news. That at Universal, earlier this morning, they decided to get rid of Mark Schmuger and David Lind, the co-chairmen of the film division. And they upped Adam Fogelson, who was the marketing maven, as reported by Variety, and Donna Langley, their president of film. So those two will be co-chairmen of the studio, effective immediately.
I like saying Schmuger. Is it just me?
Well, yeah, it is. Well, the reason that Schmuger and Lind are out is due to a string of bombs, including State of Play, Land of the Lost, Funny People, and one of your favorite films of the year, Michael, Duplicity, which I also happen to like, by the way. I think that's actually...
Oh, I have it at home. I got it on Netflix. I may watch it tonight.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, it's a good movie. The studio did have its two most profitable years ever under Schmuger and Lind, so, you know...
Schmuger!
Okay, moving on. Disney is also making a few changes. Of course, a couple of weeks ago, Dick Cook resigned, i.e. was forced out, and he was the chairman of the... I don't know what he was, basically the head of the studio. Not the chairman of the board like Robert Iger is, or the CEO the way Robert Iger is.
Like Frank Sinatra.
Right. It looks as if the Disney Channel's worldwide president, Rich Ross, will soon be elevated to a role overseeing at least the Disney-branded portion of the Mouse's studio operations, according to Variety. More importantly, over at Disney, it looks as if Miramax is going to undergo some transformation, or at least downsizing. They have, I guess it's 70 to 80 staff members now. During the summer, they were moved out of a separate office onto the studio lot. And now after Friday's board meeting at Disney, Miramax is being forced to eliminate 50 of the division's 70 jobs and cut in half the number of films it releases to just 3 a year.
That's insane. I mean, just get rid of it. 3 movies a year is not worth having a shingle for.
Well, they're going to keep it alive. I mean, Disney is...
No, they're not. They're killing it. 3 movies a year. It basically, like every studio, they had these indie specialty labels and they all realized they were in the wrong business and dumped them. And this is just, you know, Disney decided they didn't need their own specialty label either. They don't need a division to release art films, you know, 3 times a year. What's the point of that? Get out of the business. It's a waste of time.
And they're actually being credited for not totally just dumping their indie division.
They're decimating it yet again, so they're on their way to totally dumping it. I think 20 people and 3 films a year is fairly decimated.
Companies that are not indie or not small, Comcast and NBC Universal. The big news of the week was broken by Sharon Waxman's The Wrap, believe it or not, an online upstart that is covering the industry and doing apparently quite a good job, since they broke the news that Comcast was trying to purchase NBC Universal. A majority stake in NBC Universal at that.
It's a big whoop deal because these gigantic mergers are almost always done out of desperation or just to try to buy market share, and it's not a good idea and it won't work.
Well, I think this is a smart deal for Comcast because they own the pipes going into everybody's homes, whether it's television or broadband. And what they see more and more is that the television can be had in one of two ways, through their cable pipe or through their broadband pipe. And more, it's headed in the broadband pipe. So they want to own the content so that they can ultimately control it. They can decide whether it's given away for free. There was a big article in today's LA Times, will Hulu make you pay to watch? And as you both know, Hulu is just a favorite topic of mine. But 5 years ago, Comcast made an unsuccessful run to buy the Walt Disney Company for $54 billion. And it's just, it makes perfect sense that they would try to control the content that's being delivered over broadband as well as over cable.
I think it makes sense. I'm not sure I'm very happy with it.
No. I mean, think about it. You could not, if you were a movie studio, own a movie theater, which is the delivery mechanism for a motion picture film. They did away with vertical integration decades ago. And in this case, what they're saying is, yes, you can produce the content. Yes, you can own the content. And yes, you can control the delivery mechanism, which means you can charge for it whatever you want.
I don't know what to say. I don't think that it will ever actually happen.
Well, they're able to get people to pay to download shows. They do it via iTunes. They get people to watch ads on Hulu. I'm sure there'll probably be some service set up where you pay a very nominal fee and are able to watch stuff on demand online.
A lot has to happen for Comcast to actually take a majority stake in NBC Universal, including Vivendi. The French company has to unload its 20% stake in NBC. If that were to happen, you can bet that Hulu, which makes $123 million, or at least will this year, certainly will start charging for some of its content. The CEO of Comcast, Brian Roberts, was quoted during an investor conference this past May as saying, "If I am any one of these programmers, not just ESPN, but the Food Network, and I have a business in that 50%, 60%, 70% of my business comes from subscriptions, I want to think long and hard before I just put the content out there for free and not think through what it is going to do to my business."
He's okay. Wrong. You know,
yeah,
you
I'm like, what?
You get fans of the show. They don't put it out for free before it airs. They wait until it's aired on the network, and then rather than people not being able to see it at all or whatever, they put it on, you know. It's, you know, 5 minutes of Jon Stewart clips the next day just gets people to want to watch Jon Stewart. It doesn't take away from the show. And they have ads on them. You know, it's not for free. It's just like, they're for free on television. Those are free. The Food Network is free. If you pay for your TV, I know you pay your subscriber thing, but you can watch television for free.
Well, and you can listen to us for free if you download us or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We are working on the Zune Marketplace as well. Subscribe to it there or on Feedburner or in your RSS reader. You can find links to all of these subscriptions on our website, which is at showbizsandbox.com. You will also find a link there to email us so that you can send us feedback or you can comment on the stories we discussed. That is, the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, the website is where you will also find links to the show notes for this episode and all of our past episodes. And you can also find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to send us news stories via delicious.com, the social bookmarking website, feel free to do so. Just tag your links, Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. You can also give us a call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And I should mention, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the popular indie pop group, kind of like Lady Gaga, popular indie. MGMT is the name of the artist. You can visit their website at whoismgmt, or you can find them on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Of course, you can always find Karen at industrynexus.com or on Twitter, kwoody3939 is the username to look up. Michael, you're what? At michaelgiltz.com, you're on Huffington Post, you're on Twitter, at michaelgiltz is the username to look up. I can be found on Twitter. My handle, or as they say, is at Sperling, and I can also be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.